just save you an email. Yes, I think I called Angela Lansbury Jessica Lansbury. That's just a bad on my part.
So. I didn't even notice that. I didn't even notice.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region. No guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I committed no murder. You must be disappointed.
You've committed fraud. Listen, you're in a lot of trouble, Vincent. I can get you out of here.
Do you have any idea what it took to get in here?
You've gone as far as you can go. You come with me now.
Hello, everybody. It is Wreckatopia episode 129, or as this thing that I'm looking at here on the top here says Wreckoptopia Live. That's the an extra P. The extra P is for pleasant, I guess.
Yeah.
Today's big recommend is Gattaca from 1997. I'm Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Hidely ho, DNA Arenos.
Yeah, there we go. And we'd like to welcome chat who've come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Aaron, would you like to start us off with the small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
Sure. I think you've small recommended this before on the show, so apologies if this is a repeat, but I had to talk about it some more because I finally got around to seeing Navalny. I knew I was going to love this, and I knew I needed to see it, and it just kind of, you know how sometimes a movie will just hang there on your watch list and you're just like, not today.
Right, yeah.
Not today. Not today. Well, this weekend was finally that day, and man, if you haven't seen this documentary, it's on Max still. Go check it out there. It follows this political dissident from Russia. Navalny is his name, and one of the most charismatic leaders of kind of the uprise against Putin's regime, I think, is probably the easiest way to say that. And I guess I don't, I mean, it's real life. So if you've paid attention to kind of what happened, you know the pieces of the story. I'll just say that there is a phone call scene. It is the scene everybody talks about. It is mind-blowing to watch. It is a real moment in real history that feels like writers made it up for a movie. It's wild, this story. So since this came out, Navalny has since passed away in prison, I believe, in Russia. So there's even some more gravitas to this and his death and what led to it. But yeah, check out Navalny. It's well worth watching, not just for how intense and interesting it is, but also for how meaningful it is about what it means to stand up to power.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I will not be surprised if they make this into a movie, if they haven't already started. Because the phone call at the centerpiece of this documentary is one of the tensest things you'll ever see. So get it put in the hands of the right director, the scene will crackle in a biographical sort of way or whatever. But yeah, high recommend for me as well. I don't remember if I small recommended it. I know that I brought it up during the year end in review when this came out, and it had been nominated for and then won the documentary Oscar, I believe, that year. And I mentioned that one on that. I don't know if I small recommended it, but I definitely did on the year end thing. So,
yep.
I've caught up to a couple of movies that have been sort of critical darlings over the past month. One of them is Long Legs, starring Maika Monroe from It Follows. On the trail of a mysterious set of circumstances where families, there's a bunch of murders happening, and then a kid left over who doesn't remember anything at the end of it. It's kind of a Sinister-esque in the way that it sets up these murders. And Micah Monroe is one of these very, very dedicated FBI agents, and her boss is played by Blair Underwood, who actually makes an appearance in the Big Recommend today. But the story is her trying to find who's responsible for all this. And there's this performance by Nicolas Cage, which is the kind of thing we expect from Nicolas Cage these days. It's kind of amazing that we've come full circle on his insanity as an actor, because it used to be, ha ha ha, look at that. Now he's getting critically acclaimed for these type of things. And I love it. I'm one of those suckers for Nicolas Cage when he goes off the deep end on a character, and he's no different in this one. To tell you much more about the movie probably would be a disservice, because you want to kind of like see things for yourself and everything, and have revelations for yourself. But this is a great performance piece. Micah Monroe, great in this. Nicolas Cage, love. Alicia Witt's in this, and she's very good. Alicia Witt, who's in a ton of stuff, but I don't know, has had something so high profile in the past however many years at this point, and she's getting good buzz on this as well. But I very much enjoyed this movie.
Yeah, I don't think I enjoyed it quite as much as you did, but you can't take away from the fact that it's a compelling watch. Like, it's just done so well in a visual sense. I think Oz Perkins, Anthony Perkins' son, is, you know, one to watch visually for the stuff that he's doing. It didn't all add up to a lot for me, but I did find myself engaged in some of the scenes, and there's some real talent with the tension and those kind of things. So worth a watch either way, I think. My second recommend goes about as far away from Long Legs as you can, maybe. I'm gonna recommend a movie from a couple years ago called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. This came and went, and I've heard nary a person really talk about it. Has decent reviews, and so I thought I'd go back and give it a check. I missed it during that year, which I think was 2022. I think it was 22, so just a couple years ago. Leslie Manville plays the lead character, and she is phenomenal. And this is one of those movies, I'm going to comp it with Paddington, right? Where there's some real fun humor, some, you know, clever turns of phrase, some interesting plot mechanics, but really it's about the feels, right? It's about the vibes. It's about the positivity. It's about the optimism. The basic story is this is a woman from the street, from London, Cockney accent and everything, who just wants a dress designed by Christian Dior. And so she finds her way into some money. That's interesting. The way the plot gets there is kind of fun. She has a little bit, it's a little bit of a good luck, bad luck tale, where like anytime something bad happens to her, it ends up turning to good, like fortunately, unfortunately, you know, kind of thing. And so that's kind of fun. And it's very much there's a little bit of Eat the Rich to it, where, you know, the snobbishness of the wealthy and the rights they think they have over certain things are questioned by this woman's appearance in their world. And all that stuff works really, really well. I think it's a remake, actually, of a movie that came out in 92 called Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, because that would be the Cockney way of saying Harris, Harris.
Right.
Which was Jessica Lansbury, I think, lead in that one. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I'll just throw it out there. If you want like a good vibe movie to watch one night, throw this on. It's a lot of fun.
That's never going to happen, Aaron.
I believe that.
I don't like good vibes. My next small recommend, it's stunning, because Nolan in the chat said Strange Darling is better than Long Legs. I agree, Nolan. That's my next small recommend, Strange Darling. This movie is told out of order, We are told that there is a serial killer on the loose, and the very beginning of this movie is Willa Fitzgerald running away from Kyle Gallner, and it's sort of like, instead of saying, "Yeah, I bet you wonder how I got here," the movie does that for you. And so this movie goes back and forth, and this is another movie I'm going to have to be very careful about, because I don't want to reveal anything about what's going on in this movie. But what I can tell you here is Willa Fitzgerald is fucking awesome in this. And then you're talking, this is a native Nashvillian. She went to Harpeth Hall, just like Reese Witherspoon. Nashville represent. And so she is fantastic in this. Kyle Gallner has been in quite a few movies the past few years. His profile sort of steadily raising. At some point, you might see him in a bunch of good stuff. This is a great one. But you see her getting chased by him at the beginning. And all I can tell you is a lot of this movie is sort of like, okay, here's what I know now, and then the movie will go into the future, or it'll go in the past, and it will change your perception of what's going on as you go through. And that's about as far as I really want to go. I think I've gone too far even. But it's a movie that I highly, highly, highly recommend if you have not heard it. If you see it somewhere out there in the wild, go give it a look. This is a great, great movie.
Excited to see it. At some point, I'll definitely add it to my list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we all have stories. our big recommend is Gattaca from 1997.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
It is Aaron's big recommend. So, Aaron, take it away.
I was just looking in the chat, so before I get to that, just save you an email. Yes, I think I called Angela Lansbury Jessica Lansbury. That's just a bad on my part. So.
I didn't even notice that. I didn't even notice.
You know, Jessica, Angela, what's really the difference?
Sure.
Gattaca is a 1997 sci-fi thriller written and directed by Andrew Niccol. The director you'd be most surprised takes up two slots in my top 30 movies of all time. You know, Simone. It's really, really good.
Yep.
Like most great movies, we start with a scripture, a Willard Galen quote, and giant cascading fingernails. As the credits continue to play, the fingernails are joined by hair and skin cells. As we see, a man is shaving like he's in a Gillette commercial, but he is not. As we see him strap some lemonade around his thigh and prep a ketchup-filled fingerprint cover, we begin to understand that this man isn't prepping his lunch. He's actually prepping to make sure he has the right DNA handy for his day. This is Jerome, played by Ethan Hawke, and he now heads to work, where we find out he works at the space program, might be taking a trip to Titan, and works with the actor formerly known as Poison Ivy. He continues by planting skin cells in the keyboard and then taking a piss test, where the doctor makes inappropriate comments about his junk before asking him to remind him to tell him a story about his son someday. He's then caught peeping on yet another space launch, where the bride tells him, if you want to pretend not to care, maybe don't look up. After this, some narration informs us that it was always going to be this way, except that he's actually not Jerome Morrow. He's actually named Vincent, and he was born in the natural way, you know, in the backseat of a Cadillac. Vincent grew up without his dad's first name and with everyone thinking he had something wrong with him, because he did. His heart made it likely he would only live to about 30. Later, his parents gave him a younger brother the newfangled way by choosing all the genetics ahead of time. They wanted him to have a brother to play with and probably to engage in some good old-fashioned swim chicken. Vincent wanted to go to space from an early age, even though everyone told him it was unrealistic, because it was. Despite Genoism being illegal, it was easy to skirt, so he had no chance to do anything but clean up after the real astronauts. Vincent then decided to do one more game of swim chicken with his brother and somehow beat Anton, having to swim back and actually save his life. So Vincent gets that janitor job at the space program working for Ernest Borgnine, even though it just makes him that much closer to the one thing he can't have, even though he desires it so, so much. No, not Borgnine. The astronaut job. So Vincent takes his future into his own hands by contacting Monk to come in and create a new identity for him. The choice is Jerome Morrow, played by Jude Law, a perfect DNA specimen that looks enough like him to make it work and had an accident that left him in a wheelchair. All it will take is a haircut, some contact lenses, and sawing his legs in half so he can extend them a few inches. Mm-hmm. While Vincent's legs are healing, Jerome shows him a silver medal, and we begin to understand that when you're created for perfection, nothing else will suffice. We cut then to new Jerome fretting over some vodka samples that have too little urine in them as he preps to head to his interview, which consists of just one question. What's your greatest weakness? Just kidding. Deposit your pee here, please. That's all we need. But with 1 week left until launch, there's a murder of the mission director, and we see a lonely eyelash that might spell the end for our friend Vicombe. Alan Arkin puts a bloody keyboard in a bag and humorously rules out suicide. But Jerseint still feels okay, so he and the artist currently known as Eugene go out for some drinks. Meanwhile, Uma Thurman's Irene sneaks a hair from his desk and goes to a shady DNA testing site to see who he actually is. But since Jerome planted that hair there, everything checks out okay. Back at the 20s-style future speakeasy, Eugene has had too much to drink, loses his lunch, and offers to save some of the resulting DNA in case Jerome needs it later. He also admits that the accident wasn't an accident at all, and that he couldn't even get that part right. After the lingering eyelash is identified as an unregistered invalid, Arkin gets put in his place by his superior to do more interviews and less worrying about this one stray hair. After Jerome has a close call on the treadmill, he has a convenient run-in with his old boss in the stairwell, and then finds out in a walk with Irene that she won't ever be an astronaut either because she isn't perfect enough too. She offers him a hair as proof, but his clumsy butt loses it in the wind. Meanwhile, Eugene is arguing with a provider about the exact color of hair dye, even though every picture we've seen computers pull up in the future is in black and white. Jerome and Eugene then argue about whether he will get caught, with Eugene prevailing and convincing him to keep at it and go for launch. Jerome takes Irene to a concert that doubles as a haunting score to the continued investigation as Eugene gets his blood tested by Hank from Breaking Bad, protests that he's just an injured astronaut, and the police start to do more and more sweeps. The world is closing in. After the concert, we learn that the pianist has 12 fingers, so he can play better, when I'd think the better way to go would have been to just have two penises. The lovely couple has to go through a police check on the way back, where Jerome has to lie about his swab being contaminated and discard his contacts. This leads to a scary moment when Irene somehow needs him to cross a busy highway to see the sunrise. And the movie pretends hesitating to cross an interstate would somehow be suspicious, either way. A second sample is found on the same coincidental cup the coincidental Bohr 9 coincidentally collected earlier, so now Arkin wants to go straight to the vein. But when they try to stick Jerome, he does some absolutely vile sleight of hand to avoid detection, and even though Arkin wants to test again, his young superior refuses to do so. Later at another 20s speakeasy, Jerome and Irene listen to some saxophone and get raided by the police. They escape out the back, and a cop station there finds himself on the wrong side of four punches and a headbutt, so they run down the alleyway out of sight. As the two of them hide, the cop yells out a familiar name, Vincent. And you might think that that would scare Irene away, but apparently secret names get her all riled up because she immediately wants to do everyone's favorite kind of DNA swap with him.
Right.
Jerome then picks the most uncomfortable way possible to clean up after sex before Irene tells him she thinks he had something to do with the director's death. The next day at work, Irene sees them focusing on Jerome's workspace and hints to Jerome that he's not feeling well, leading to an intense race to let Eugene know that he has to arm climb up the specifically shaped set of stairs in time to pretend to be himself just one last time. On the verge of discovering the secret, the detective gets a phone call just in the deus ex nihilo of time to head back because they found the killer. Now a new Jerome, then gives Irene a pep talk about what's possible, and Alan Arkin reveals that there was spit found in the mission director's eye, so the invalid had nothing to do with it, and Jerome is free. But there's just one problem. Jerome knows who the detective is, and the detective knows who Jerome is. Turns out, it's his brother. After arguing about who deserves what, they know they have to settle it in the only way possible, some more swim chicken. But this time in the dark. As they swim out, Anton begins to falter and can't figure out how Vincent is doing all this. The answer? He didn't save anything for the swim back. An amazing moment, beautifully inspirational, only undercut by the fact that clearly his brother didn't save anything either because he had to save him from drowning both times. Mm-hmm. Irene and Jerome share one more night together after she clumsily drops his hair as well. Back at home, Eugene has prepared years of samples for the once and future Vincent because he too is going on a journey. And we know he means he's actually ending his journey after Vincent leaves. Before getting on the craft, there's one last unannounced pee test. But just as we start to think, you're in trouble now, mister, the sample doc reveals he knew all along because right-handed men don't do left-handed aiming. And changes the result with the built-in move the plot along by changing the result to the right person button.
Yeah, he just presses a button.
It's just, oh, that fixes it. As Vincent enters the spacecraft and Jerome enters his final resting place, the flames of propulsion mirrored with the flames of destruction do their respective jobs. Both men going home, one the result of a promise left unfulfilled, and one the result of an unbreachable barrier left behind in human dust. As a final fingernail falls after the credits, we are left to wonder what defines us, our limitations, or our response to them, and how Vincent managed to survive never being able to take a dump while at work. And that is Gattaca. Chris, what did you think this time
through? Yeah, I've always loved Gattaca. This is one of those, this is like my first movie theater experience. Like when I was at my first movie theater, I'd been there for a while when this came out, but this is a movie that came and went, man. It did not do well at all at the box office. It has sort of gained a lot of momentum over the years. I saw something in the IMDb trivia that said something like NASA scientists rated this the most accurate movie of all time or something like that.
Interesting.
I don't know why they made that vote, but I'd like to know more. this is the I remember this was the first time I had ever seen Jude Law, and looking at the IMDb, it's probably the first time I had a chance to see Jude Law, because everything before that, he had done like three or four things.
Mm-hmm.
This was the movie that propelled him to be in everything. Afterwards, he was in so many things after this, that we'll have to get drunk immediately is such a great line. But Jude Law is so good in this, and Ethan Hawke is his usual good self, and Uma Thurman's is usually her usual good self, but this is like sort of Jude Law's coming out party, for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a look at, my notes on this one, the swimming theme in this movie is either brilliant or heavy-handed or both, and but I do love it. It's a sperm metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
The creation of life goes to the fastest swimmer, whereas the people being created in this new world are being assisted, given their new life without earning it. And the metaphor might get into the heavy-handed territory when Vincent beats Anton in the last race and says he didn't save anything for the swim back. Which, as we know, sperm are looking to go in one direction and never return.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the movie is astute in pointing out that in a world where everyone is given genetic advantages, you're still going to end up in the same rat race. The idea is embodied by Jude Law, who's been told all his life that he's the best of the best of the best. He can't handle it when he finishes second in a swimming competition. Again, swimming coming back into the theme of the movie. It's also embodied by Uma Thurman, who's given a whole bunch of advantages, but still can't crack the elite because of a faint possibility of a heart condition. And I also feel like it's embodied by Alan Arkin as well, who's a true detective, probably superior to Anton, but because Anton won the DNA lottery, he's Arkin's boss.
Mm-hmm.
Arkin's the guy who's really doing stuff in here. You know, and Anton, to be fair to his character, he kind of suspects it's his brother, so he's probably not motivated to do the best in this. But he still ends up feeling kind of like a dumbass compared to Alan Arkin in this. And so it's possible that in other cases, he's just brilliant for all I know. But that's the sort of the vibe you get in this whole thing. I love Xander Berkeley, by the way. He was in everything in the 90s. I love his character, and nothing gets past him. We find out by the end that he's known about Vincent the whole time. And the first clue that he knows about Vincent is when he says, "Ah, Vincent never fails, can always piss on command."
Mm-hmm.
And he becomes Vincent's champion because he has a son who thinks he can be special, but society won't let him. Xander Berkeley was in just so many movies. And I don't know if you've ever, this is sort of a total tangent, but when web series were becoming sort of a bigger thing, he was in a thing called The Booth at the End. Have you ever seen that?
Mm-mm. No, I don't think I've heard of that.
I would recommend watching The Booth at the End. It's only two seasons. I don't know if it finished its story officially, but they're all like very like 5 to 10 minute episodes or whatever. You can finish both seasons in a day if you want to. I highly recommend that because Xander Berkeley's so good in that. So anyway, that was an aside. Something that might get overlooked in this movie is the relationship between Jerome and Vincent. Jerome is highly prejudiced against Vincent for a while. He doesn't think he can pass himself off as Jerome for the mere fact that his DNA dictates that he won't. But he really grows to appreciate Vincent, and there's a true friendship at the end. And I feel like this is how people grow to appreciate each other, even with their differences, spending time to getting to know how the other side lives. And that's not going to happen for everybody. I'm not going to say that, you know, oh, if we could all just hold hands across America and we'd all love each other. I don't think that's the way it works, but I think it would work if you give more people in your life a chance here and there. And that's sort of what I got out of that. The scene where Jude Law, you mentioned this, the scene where Jude Law has to climb the stairs and try to get upright before Lauren Dean shows up is great. Love that scene. That score by Michael Nyman, I don't know how he pronounces it, it has stayed with me since I first saw this movie. It's that good. It's one of those, I can't explain it, but that theme goes through my head like weekly, probably.
Wow.
Or maybe not weekly, but enough like it's, you know, that it's like, it just pops into my head. I love that score so much. And I guess, you know, when you have something that's got, it's a good tune and it's played throughout, it's repetitive and everything, maybe it does stick with you for more than your average scores. But this one has stuck with me forever. I this is a bit heavy-handed too, but I do like how Vincent is on the treadmill and there's the investigation going on, and Gore Vidal is like, "No one exceeds his potential," and then there's a, "Well, and if he does, it means we did not accurately gauge his potential in the first place." While Ethan Hawke is sitting there running on the treadmill and everything, I like that scene a lot. I didn't quite understand this scene. I guess Uma Thurman is trying to figure out, she suspects Ethan Hawke. So she goes to that drive-by DNA place.
Right, right.
I feel like that place is made for matchmaking, right?
Yeah.
Women are going there, or maybe men are too, but we're seeing mostly women show up to the tellers. The first one is like, "I just kissed this guy 5 minutes ago," and she wants to see what his DNA is so that I'm assuming so that he's appropriate to date.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Uma Thurman is just bringing it in just so that she can secretly figure out if this person is saying who he says he is. I think I may just realize that right now, because then she falls in love with him right after that. And I'm like, is there kind of a dual thing going on there? Like where she kind of like, "Oh, this guy's impressive. I think I'll date this guy now," you know?
Mm.
So I don't know. Maybe it is just to check on whether he's just, you know, who he says he is. But also right after that, turns out, hey, they're a pretty good match, which is funny too, because later on, when she does kiss the person who actually has that DNA, there's nothing there, which sort of goes to show what, you know, it's not about your DNA. It's about who you fall in love with and you know, what that person is, not what that person is made of and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're missing something in this murder mystery.
Okay.
It feels like Andrew Nicole has sort of forced to make trims or outright drastic cuts from the get-go. When the director gets killed, Vincent mentions that he was the closest to finding him out. And I don't know if we even meet this dude that supposedly nearly found Vincent out. You would think that there would be some scenes in there that would say, oh no, he's about to get caught. He's messing up in front of this guy. But he's murdered before we even know who that dude is. So I felt like that was missing something. And I think we could have benefited to see that play out a bit before the long narration sequence. You're going to say something?
Yeah, I think I didn't interpret that his superior was close to finding him out.
He says it in the narration.
I thought, are you talking about the part that says, ironically, his death, he would come closer to stop me in his death than he would in his life? Or is that the quote? Something like that. I'll have to look up the exact quote. Or was there something else I missed? Because
I think he just straight up says, the guy who was closest to finding me is the one who ends up dying. He says that in the narration.
Okay.
Maybe I completely misunderstood that.
It's fine. Yeah. I will tell you my interpretation, and it may be based on something I missed that was said that you heard. My interpretation was just that the mission director was trying to scrap the launch. That's why he was killed, because the guy in charge wanted this launch to go on. And so once they had gotten too far to stop it, he admitted that he did it, because the mission director was pushing to scrub the launch.
No, I understand what happened. What I don't understand is, from the narration, it says this guy was the closest to finding me out is what I remember him saying. Maybe he doesn't say that. To be continued, maybe. We have to go and look that back up. I thought just at the murder scene, the idea was this guy was the closest to find me out, and now he's dead, and now because he's dead, I might actually get found out. That's what I took from that.
There's a quote. There's a quote that's something along the lines of, in his death, he was much closer to stopping me than in his life. And I thought the stopping me was stopping the launch, but maybe there was something more specific.
I guess it's possible that's what he meant, and I interpreted it as, like, I just thought he said finding him out, like nearly figured out who he was.
Right.
So, anyway, I feel like we could have, you know, seen that a little bit more if that's the case. And then getting to the nitty gritty about that launch, I don't really get the whole conflict about the launch. Why one guy wanted to delay it and the other one is so gung-ho to proceed, he kills the other guy for it? Because there are launches all the time in this movie. Like, you can't go into the building without seeing one flying up in the air. So I don't know why this particular one is such a big deal.
Sure.
It kind of feels thrown in a little bit. So, like, you know, it's kind of that's one thing I didn't quite. I feel like if he got a chance to flesh it out, and maybe he did, and he just made the mistake on his own, but it feels like Sony is, like, sitting there going, we need this to be under 2 hours, man. We can't do this murder mystery thing. That's not even important. So that would make sense that it got chopped for that reason, even though I disagree with it. The other one that I was like, did Vincent get tipped off about the blood test from the vein? He has, like, a very specific plunger thing to pass that test.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that was supposed to be a surprise. And when you first watch it, you're like, oh, well, maybe the brother is passing on, but the brother is definitely not helping him out. And nobody, and then at the end, you're like, maybe Xander Berkeley is helping him out. No, Xander Berkeley's saving that carrot for the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. He hasn't let on that he knows yet. So I'm just like, how does he know? Does he always bring a vial of blood with him?
my rationalization guess is just that they announced those tests the day before, you know, like they announced, hey, we're doing, you know, but that would be dumb. If you're an investigation.
I don't understand why they would tell them that if that was the point. Yeah. Like you've been passing by this whole time. obviously you have methods. You're not going to tell the people that, hey, we're going to have a blood test tomorrow. Be sure to be prepared for that.
Yeah.
I think it's funny too that I'm sending this movie now,
no,
even though
good,
I love
good.
It. I think it's funny that after all of this time, after all of this investigation, a little swab of the dead body, and they come up with Gore Vidal almost immediately. And then it's like, oh, the investigation's kind of MacGuffin in this movie, isn't
it? It is.
And then I think it's funny that they make the point that you don't even have to look like the person you're imitating because people just look at the DNA. Then they spend a lot of time and effort making sure Ethan Hawke looks like Jude Law. I thought that was funny. Like, there's Tony Shalhoub in that one little, that nice little scene where he's in there. It's like, he's like, you could use my picture, for God's sake. And then they're like, let's do surgery on your legs so that you're tall. And let's make sure that you have contacts. And there's another thing I didn't get. You can't do surgery on the eyes because they'll notice the scars, but they won't notice contact lenses. Okay. Anyway. That's enough sinning of the movie. I do love this movie.
I had similar, you know, thoughts going through it with a lot of that stuff. And I even mentioned, you know, some of the wildness even in the, you know, talking about the movie just at the end, just his ability to change the result with the push of a button to the correct result just slayed me this time through.
Yeah.
my sin brain was all over that one.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, I think this was the movie. What is this? 97. So, yeah, I would have been, you know, later college years for me. I think this movie is one of the movies where I watched it and I went, oh, movies can be something more. And you mentioned that some of the stuff may feel a little heavy-handed, those kind of things. But at the time, I just remember feeling that this movie was genius from start to finish. Like, the way this script is layered, not just with really interesting metaphors and ideas. You mentioned the swimming one, but a spaceship going to a planet is also very, very sperm going to egg kind of thing. And again, the comments throughout, I don't need to, you know, worry about coming back. Once I'm on the spaceship, you know, there's nothing they can do about it. Like, there's a real theme there in both of those ways. It's purposeful that he's an astronaut. It's purposeful that all the defects are heart defects, because we think of the heart as the effort, as the, you know, do you have the heart to make something happen? Do you have the heart to overcome your obstacles? And he and the Uma Thurman character both literally have faulty hearts, and yet they have stronger hearts than everyone else in the movie. Like, there's all of these, you know, kind of things, or he does, and he's inspiring her to find that in herself as well. So there's all this stuff about our limitations and how they define us, or, you know, obstacles. There's all this stuff about privilege, and the way this movie conceptualizes privilege is interestingly different than the way we talk about privilege today, but there are some similarities there too.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this is a great movie for understanding how privilege, whether chosen or not, impacts ability, and also how overcoming obstacles the idea of being a victim and overcoming obstacles are not mutually exclusive, but can work together to create something better, something bigger.
I don't know if he was thinking, I don't know if Andrew Niccol was thinking of this when he wrote this scene, but that whole, the privilege and everything that is very much embodied in that scene where Jude Law is yelling at Dean Norris in that scene, who's playing the cop. Who would get away with that other than someone who's superior in society or whatever? Like, certainly not some scrub on the street is going to be able to be like, I demand to know what your badge number is. You, how dare you? Like, this is the only right. person in society who could possibly get away with this type of thing.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. The other thing when I watched it the first time where I was like, oh, this is Pantheon movie for me, is him climbing the stairs that are shaped like a helix. It's right there. The idea that, you know, everybody is fighting against the way they were built, their limitations. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, he's fighting against self-inflicted limitations, which is different. I thought all that stuff was really interesting. I think this movie is full of incredible quotes, incredible turns of phrase. Mm-hmm. I was never more certain how far I was away from my goal than when I was standing right beside it. Just such a beautiful way to say that. The conversation with Bordenine about don't clean the glass too well, and the way that's turned from seeing what you can't have to seeing what somebody else has done, you know, being inspired by somebody else. You also have the characters who are, god children or whatever, the various different things they were called in this movie, which I love. I love the world building terminology and that kind of degenerates, you know, those kind of things are really, really interesting. But all those characters are giving extra effort just to, you know, validate their existence. And so it's the irony involved in the cup that could have done him in coming from his boss who was taking a little extra effort to go, can I take care of that cup for you? You know, sir, on the stairwell or whatever. It's just in, you know, the Arkin character, you know, going the extra mile and actually, you know, figuring out the spit thing or whatever. Like, you know, it all comes into play from these characters that aren't, you know, the ones that are built to win or whatever, I think is really interesting. Where he says, I would calm myself during the pain by thinking that when I woke, when I was done, I'd be exactly 2 inches closer to the stars.
Yeah.
Oh, just like the pain you go through for the smallest of gains, right? Like that's just what I'm saying. Like the script in this just has these real philosophically meaningful things to say that I always really enjoyed. There was the way the movie does the world building and the way people talk just feels so real. Like, you know, you could go anywhere with that guy's helix tucked under your arm, you know, like, it's just really smart about the way it says these things. I also found, speaking of heart, the one thing I just thought of this time, there's a scene where he says, how much of this do you need, when he's on the wheelchair and he's recording his heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And he says, I need 20 minutes or whatever. And as I'm watching the scene where he gets, where they come in and do the investigation, I'm now wondering, did he stop because he had to? We know he was going to have to soon. Or did the recording, I think the recording ran out. Is that what we're supposed to, are we supposed to put those two things together?
Yeah, I don't quite understand that, because it's either that his heart is beating so hard that it's overtaking the recording, or he's run out of recording. I
think
he's
run out of recording. I am watching this time, I'm pretty sure that the 20 minutes runs out, so that stops, and then we hear his actual heartbeat. And boy, the metaphor there is really interesting too, that the heartbeat that gives out is the privileged heartbeat, but the heartbeat that keeps going is, you know, the one who wants it more or needs it more or whatever. Like, I don't know. I just, every time I watch it, and that's been a bunch of times, I find more and more to really love about what it's doing. So, yeah, I could go on and on, but that's plenty of the kind of the highlights for me this time through.
Yeah. Okay. And going on to our super secret double feature.
So just like you, I like to save money, and that's why when Mint Mobile came over to our little corner of the internet, I started to pay attention. And let me tell you, something interesting happened. I realized that I think I have an unhealthy relationship with my existing provider. I had to do this thing where it's like, should I try something new? No, I've been with this provider for so long. And then I got to looking at my bill and I thought, do I really want to keep spending this much money when it appears that Mint Mobile can do the exact same for $15 a month? And that's when I started to click around and find out. To get started, I did just what you can do. Go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. And then right there is where I saw the 3-month plans that were like $15 a month. And that includes the unlimited plan. All of the plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text, and they deliver all that on the nation's largest 5G network, which is great. Even better, you can use your own phone number. And I'm kind of, you know, connected emotionally to my phone number. Another thing I probably should dig into in therapy. So to get this new customer offer and your new 3-month premium wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/recotopia. That's mintmobile.com/recotopia. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/recotopia. There is a $45 upfront payment required that's equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan, and additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I thought of quite a few on this one to start off. One of them was In Time, because the currency in this movie is DNA, and I felt like the currency and In Time being time was kind of tied to the same kind of deal. It sort of has the same kind of setup in a way, as far as who's privileged and who's not, and that sort of thing. And then there's a couple of DNA movies out there that have this this sort of feel to it, like The Island and Never Let You Go have kind of have this DNA type of thing going on in it that makes sense. But there's a really fun one, I think, in this one, and it's another one in which someone is constantly trying to take Jude Law's identity, and that's talented Mr. Ripley.
Perfect.
In which Matt Damon is trying to do this exact thing to try to pass off as, because he hates being a nobody. Why be a real nobody when you can be a great somebody, or whatever that great line is that I can't think of the top of my head. But yeah, this is one of those. I feel like it works perfectly with this for that very reason. You have Jude Law at the center of it, and someone's trying to steal his identity, and that's as far as I went with it. There's some slight similarities in this, especially in class and privilege and things of that nature, where Matt Damon is trying to up the ladder, so to speak, in this. Of course, he's doing it under a more sinister circumstances.
It really is the non-consent version of Gattaca. The ideas are very similar. The idea of privilege is all there in the talented Mr. Ripley, and he wants, you know, the privilege that he doesn't have, and he's willing to do anything to get it. It's just the matter of consent and morality that kind of change the two perspectives on what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Next week's homework, we are sticking to the year 1997, which, as it turns out, is a sneaky good year. I have like two in the chamber that could go. I nearly thought about like not doing this, because 1997 is going through my head quite a bit. But this is a movie I have not seen in a long time. I know that I liked it when I watched it. Now, may not like it now, who knows, but it's gotten a decent following since. The movie Breakdown, starring Kurt Russell, directed by Jonathan Mostow. This is car breaks down, wife gets abducted type movie, and so you gotta, it's one of those type of thrillers. So I was I'm looking forward to revisiting this one. It's something that popped into my head because it recently came out on Blu-ray, and I bought that, and I want an excuse to watch the Blu-ray again. And so I remember enjoying this movie very, very much. Have you ever seen Breakdown?
I have not. This will be my first time. I'm excited to watch it.
Yeah. All right. Awesome.
Before we go on to any questions, if you'll allow me, I want to address something from the comments because it was something I also kind of wanted to talk about.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Somebody says, I did feel a bit iffy when Vincent mentioned racism being a minimal issue in this world, and yet the cast is predominantly white. I thought about this a lot, and I think that's intentional. And the reason I give the movie credit for this maybe being something Vincent is saying from a different type of privilege and not understanding is because the movie does comment on it earlier when, among listing the things, they specifically cast the only black member of the cast, really, to list one of the things as being preferred as fair skin.
He has a knowing smile when he says it. Yeah.
And so I think the movie is specifically saying how nefarious eugenics can be in the case of race, because it belies a racism that, you know, when you're not picking your baby's race or your baby's skin tone or those kind of things, that you don't even have to think about. And so I think the movie is saying that people are choosing white babies because people are racist, and that's the reason that there's a lot of white people in this movie. Now, that doesn't resolve the movie's, you know, guilt for, you know, diverse casting, those kind of things, that. But I do think the movie is making a point there, but maybe I'm misunderstanding. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I thought that it was an oversight in the movie's part for not exploring it a little bit more.
Sure. Now, yeah.
Now, yes, you could be saying that he's an unreliable narrator in this case. Everything about what he said in this movie has been right. He's been right the whole time. So for him to say things like racism aren't a big deal anymore, we're supposed to kind of accept that, I think. So it's something that, obviously, and then I wonder if Blair Underwood just kind of did that acting move on his own. He wasn't really like doing something that was inherent in the script that Andrew Niccol gave him. He was just like, oh yeah, everybody wants the fair skin, huh? You know,
I would love to ask, because I think I really feel like a black actor was purposefully cast for that role to say that line, but I could be totally wrong. It's possible.
Yeah. But yeah, this is something where, again, if you have room for a series or a 2.5-hour movie, you could probably explore those things a little bit more. But I agree with you. I think that the fact that everybody is white pretty much in this movie is sort of on purpose, but it does a disservice by not actually exploring that topic a little bit more. So that did stick out like a sore thumb here in 2024. Something that may not have stuck out in 1997 when it came out.
Well, and you could have the same conversation to a lesser degree about the gender separation in the movie as well. You know, that there are so many more men than there are women, and maybe the movie is intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know. It also has an aesthetic of a different time. It literally has like a 20s, 30s aesthetic, like all the cars, all the bars, all that kind of stuff. So I wonder if it's making some sort of commentary about the idea that when you choose, you belie your prejudices, and all of a sudden there's, 75% men because everybody wants boys or, whatever. Because they're going to have more of a chance. I don't know.
And look at how we sort of, what glimpses we get into women in this movie is, we get a caring mother at the beginning of it, which, that's whatever, that she's gone before the movie really, really starts. But Uma Thurman is hit on by all three of the male leads in this movie.
Yeah.
So fun. Like twice within 5 minutes of each other. And then later Jude Law does it. And then the other memorable woman is the one who goes to that matchmaking place and is like looking for a man and all that type of thing. So yeah, there's not, you could say that's a statement. It could also be an omission on their part that they didn't explore these things a little bit more.
Yeah.
So
that kind of to like explore that is a little deeper than this movie probably had, you know, felt like it had a chance to go, but
all right. Let's do a question.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
What is the weirdest flavor combination that you love?
Okay, so if you're talking about weird flavor combinations, I am absolutely the wrong person to ask this question. I am what's known as a super taster, so weird flavor combinations mess with my brain. It's hard to justify them. So like peanut butter and banana, that's about as weird as a flavor combination as I get. But I do love peanut butter and banana and maybe some honey. So there you go.
I don't think I've ever had peanut butter and banana.
That's a good one.
I have to try that at some point. I'm going to go ahead and tell everybody what Jeremy's was on this one too, because mine's not too terribly great either. But Jeremy says, this is tough because I have a very traditional palate. I guess tomato, white wine, and fish. Very surprised by this combination that ended up being delicious and brought new flavors. Yeah, that's another one I have not tried whatsoever. One that I love, but I don't actually do very often. I put brown sugar on my eggs every once in a while, and it tastes great. I don't know why it does, but it tastes great. And so, yeah, I've had that before where it was just, and it's really because I've missed my oatmeal or whatever. And the sugar goes onto the eggs. And you sit there, and it's actually a pretty delightful flavor combination when it comes down to it.
Nice.
Let's see. Over on the chat, Josh says, cottage cheese and cayenne. Huh. Okay. All right. Slab says, maybe not flavor, but Slim Jims and Cheetos. That's definitely a flavor. That's a flavor right there, man.
It's a lot of flavor.
Yeah. Lucas says, I like corn ice cream, like loose corn in the ice cream. Oh my goodness. Okay.
Corn on the cone.
Yes. Nolan says milk and pizza. Yeah, that is a combination.
I
right
do
there.
Like that. Well, I don't know if I do anymore. I used to do that all the time in high school.
We would
get a pepperoni pizza and I would pour myself 32 ounces of milk, and that was my favorite thing to drink with pizza. So I do remember that.
Shaggy says SpaghettiOs and smoked sausage. Okay. You're kind of getting close to an actual spaghetti dinner though around that one, aren't you? Spaghetti and meatballs. Let's see. Slab says, love my mandarin oranges on my pizza. Mo. Now that may be a bridge too far. Right.
Come on. There. What are we doing?
Yeah, that almost sounds trolly, but oh my God. Josh says, I once pickled watermelon rinds also. That was weird. Not a fave though. I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't think so.
It was interesting. I guess I actually do like something weird. We got into a huge discussion on our work Slack. 3-day long discussion about whether or not beans should be allowed on potatoes. Jeremy was very much against the idea. He's not here to defend his
that
position.
That was that conversation I was ignoring.
Yes, it was.
I remember looking at my phone and there was like 40 notifications about beans.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, that's something that I cannot contribute to whatsoever. I'm not even going to try.
So I think we located that baked beans in Jeremy's mind are like brown sugar, syrupy, sweet beans. And I remember my mom making these kind of baked beans. She's from Indiana as well. So I think it's a Midwest kind of baked beans with a lot of sugar. And he didn't want sugar on his baked potato, I think, was kind of the idea. But also, he doesn't like combining starches. And it was really interesting to me because I would eat beans on a potato or other, you know, I would eat, you know, chili on a potato. That sounds delicious, but there's beans in chili. So anyways, it was a huge conversation. And so I guess maybe that's the answer I should go with.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. okay. If I can compose myself a little bit. All right. Next week will be breakdown. It'll be, that'll be fun to revisit. I hope you guys enjoy it as well. But that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, chat, thank you for coming out and, bringing it today. Very much appreciate you guys coming out every week. It's awesome. But that's going to do it for this week. We'll see you next time.
See you guys.
See ya. Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I saw, this is going to be a small recommend, but I saw Long Legs at Belcourt. And
yeah,
don't believe that Belcourt was showing the movie, but Alicia Witt apparently is from Nashville and I guess arranged through the Belcourt to have like a special showing there where she would do a Q&A. And I got wind of this, through Jonathan, and I went ahead and bought a ticket to it when I heard about it.
Nice.
And enjoyed the movie, and I stayed around for the Q&A, not really for the people in the audience asking their questions. I always get a little eye-rolly when people in the audience start asking questions.
There's always some good ones, right?
It's just, I mean, I'm sure they're, this time I probably left, and the people asked some very insightful questions, I'd be horrified to learn that I missed that, but most of the time it feels like people who get called on in those situations are always looking to see how smart they are and all that type of stuff. Or maybe it's just me projecting. I don't know. But anyway, it's fun seeing somebody from the movie talk about their movie, especially when you're in your hometown and you didn't have to go to a festival to watch it or anything like that. And, even in that setting, it's like I get this air of pretentiousness about everything when they're talking about their movie and everything, and it doesn't seem real when they're talking about it. And I don't want to cast any kind of like shadow over the event. Very happy that the event took place. Don't want to say anything negative about it. It just seems like, you know, once an actor starts talking about their process and, you know, all this stuff, it's kind of, I don't really care. It doesn't really get me. It doesn't make me learn much about it, really. I don't know. I kind of like just lose interest at that point. I just want to hear what it was like when Nicolas Cage started doing a whole bunch of crazy shit. How do you act off of that and everything? Maybe I should have asked questions.
Due to my work in the Critics' Choice, I've been at many interview style kind of things. Mm-hmm. And one of the first ones I ever went to was for The Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a junket, you know, there's 50 of us maybe in the room. And it's Scorsese, Pacino, and De Niro. Like, you know, it's like Mount Rushmore, you know, just sitting crazy in front of me or whatever. And they were like, hey, if you want to ask a question, just grab a number, you know, and then we'll draw numbers. And if your number is called, you know, you can ask a question or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that sounds fun. I'll do that. Meanwhile, I'm just kind of in awe of a lot because it's, you know, one of my first ones and these are my heroes or whatever. So I'm not thinking about my question. They call my number first. You know, if they call somebody else, I'm like, oh, yeah, I have a number. I should think of something to ask. I have nothing prepared for this question at this moment.
You're like Ralphie in A Christmas Story when he got the Santa Claus.
So I mumbled some sort of question, about relating their careers to the movie or something, and how choices in life take us in different directions, whatever, what's a choice you've made in your career that you wonder how the different directions would have gone. They looked at me like I had asked them to describe the composition of the moon. Like mm-hmm. it was one of those moments where I felt myself shrinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. So yeah, that's awful, especially those three guys.
Right?
I mean, it would be one thing if it was like Tom Holland or something like that.
Yeah, no, it just happened to be like three of the biggest heroes of cinema, mm-hmm. and I had to go first. So I will tell you this, I've never taken a number since.
When we did interviews on, when we're doing the Sincast and everything, I always like had fun with those because I could prepare the questions and decide which ones were not good enough and all of that. You could ask multiple questions.
Exactly.
When you have to ask one, you have to... Did they answer the question, by the way? I know that
eventually,
they said the composition. Yeah.
Eventually, I think Pacino bailed me out, with something. But, I think Scorsese said something like, well, of course I think of other, directions. I think of, ways my career could have gone all the time, but mm-hmm. it is what it is or something like that.
Right.
And I got the sense that none of them liked that exercise, that there was something about that exercise that, probably felt too complicated in the moment to actually parse. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. But yeah, Pacino answered something, if I remember. I actually have video of it somewhere. They were videoing the whole thing.
The thing with it, there's a weird thing about Pacino and De Niro, right? Because they were in the same movie, Godfather 2, but had no scenes together,
right?
And then Heat was the big, oh, they're in the same movie, mm-hmm. and they're in the same timeline, the same time together and all that, but really have only one scene together. And even that people took apart, because there's never really a shot of them in the same frame
mm-hmm.
in Heat. And then they did Righteous Kill, which was a terrible movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, like, now they're well past their primes and everything. And they're like doing The Irishman, which, again, the latter day Scorsese doing Netflix movies, I've not been a fan of these movies. The Irishman had kind of a small window there where people loved it. I don't think I ever hear about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's another movie that it's kind of like, oh, that's what we got. That's the culmination of you guys' careers, huh? So you put when we finally get to see you in there, but you're not at the height of your powers and everything.
Right.
I think we all hope that we can see that 70s movie with them in it, or that 80s or, even 90s movie. Heat's going to have to be enough for everybody. Heat's a great movie.
Well, it's in all artists, actors, performers get recontextualized as they grow older too. De Niro's mm-hmm. done a bunch of dumb comedies, like paycheck yeah. comedies, right? And Pacino has kind of been called out for his sameness of that, performance that he does, that, mm-hmm. big voice. I'm trying, what's the movie where he's blind and
Sin of a Woman,
like that kind mm-hmm. of big Sin of a Woman performance. So it's almost impossible anymore to feel the same feelings you have about an actor's gravitas once they've, kind of gone through their whole career. And I don't know that that's fair. It's just something that happens,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're never going to get the same feel of what De Niro Pacino means in a movie now, that you might have then.
Right.
Are they both in the new, the Heat 2 or whatever that's coming out?
I haven't read much on that.
I haven't actually. Either. I just know Michael Mann wanted to do it.
Didn't he start that out as a novel
Yes, I think it was a novel first. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Seeing the actors that pop up at the beginning makes me think this might be a prequel or something. We'll see.
This
is one of those that's kind of a nebulous thing. Right now, there's only two actors that are possibly there. It says rumored on the IMDb. I love that. Just don't even put it on the cast list if it's rumored. But they have rumored. Yeah, this has got to be a prequel. Austin Butler is Christian Hurlis, who was Val Kilmer's character.
Okay.
And then Adam Driver is young Neil McCauley. So that's young De Niro, but yeah. So who knows? I don't know. That's one of those projects that's like, yeah, they don't have very much ironed out. Christmas Day, Heat 2.
Who are the two actors, and when I say actors, non-gender, male, female, whatever.
Right.
That would be the De Niro Pacino wish they had been in a movie together doing something amazing. Like, is it Daniel Day-Lewis, Meryl Streep? Like, is it like, what's the equivalent today? But even, you know, their generation is, you know, last generation. So I just wonder what current generation, like, if that's even a thing.
Someone just younger than De Niro and Pacino, or somebody that today that's like in their 30s or 40s.
I'm either way. Like, I was just trying to think of, you know, like Cruise and Hanks. Have they ever done something together? Like, you know,
no, they haven't. I can't even imagine what a Cruise Hanks movie would be like. you could advertise it the Toms, you know, the two Toms, but
double that the would be Tom. Amazing.
Consider this: Cruise and Hanks could pay for that movie themselves if they wanted to and release it on their own. But who knows, maybe I sometimes wonder, like, is ego that much of a big deal to these guys, like, that they have to be? I don't know if Hanks has kind of felt a little more humbler these days. He's like, you know, I'm getting old, I'm just gonna kind of, I can be a background guy if I need to be, like, kind of a supporting. Cruise hasn't gotten there quite yet. He's tried in the past even, but I don't know.
I miss, like, Tropic Thunder, Magnolia. Like, I miss that Cruise. I really miss that Cruise.
Yeah. But yeah, this would be, I always sit there and think, man, it would be so cool to get a lot of these actors all together at once, these just heavy hitters. And really, honestly, again, they could all pay for it themselves and then reap the whirlwind when it comes out. And it's just, I don't know.
This summer, bring your drumstick to the theater, because we're bringing you the Tom Tom.
Yeah.